Welcome to Gorgeous Reads on Radio Gorgeous, in association with the books page of Sainsbury's Magazine. For more information, go to sainsburysmagazine.co.uk, radiogorgeous.com.
Sarah Taylor, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
This is your second novel.
Yes, it is.
Your first novel, very lauded, The Shore. This is your second novel, The Lures, which I also assume is going to be highly lauded. You tell us the story in your words. Encapsulate Dolores.
Well, the story starts in the middle of the night. Alex is used to listening to their parents fight pretty much every night, and this is the night that the fighting suddenly stops. And Ma walks in, picks Alex up, throws him in the back of the car, and they leave. And they go back across the country to all of the places that Alex's mother lived when she was a teenager in foster care and maybe a little bit older, just running around on her own, and settle the things that she didn't get to settle when she was there the first time. And then when they get to the end of the road, Alex has to decide what being an adult means and whether or not they should stay there with their mother or go back and find the dad that was left behind.
And It's like a buddy road trip. It's but it does start off, I love the opening, because even though I was adopted, I definitely had the same feeling that Alex has, in that our parents spring to life when we are born, and their purpose in life was to get to that point until we were born. And that has been Alex's assumption until this moment. And Alex and Ma go on this sort of odyssey. And it turns out, I sort of thought of it as well as like a farewell tour of Ma's sort of expunging the ghosts of her past, burning, you know, baptism through fire into, you know, of her inauthentic self, you know, and it's very much her journey, driven by her, and parts of herself are revealed during this journey. And it's a journey, it is like the Odyssey. There's, you know, there's gorgons of, you know, of her past.
You're saying that.
Yeah. You know, there's religious sects, there's, you know, all of the ghosts of her past, and all the who it was populated by, and what colored her experience. Tell me about Ma.
That's a really big open-ended question. I think originally, when I started writing the book, it was going to be a short story about a small child being kidnapped off their parents' front porch by someone who turns out to be a relative. And it turns out that relative had very good first intentions. But as I wrote the story, it turned itself into a novel, and I realized that the mother really is central to everything. And really, that's in a way true to life, because everyone goes through life thinking of themselves as the protagonist of their own stories, but we forget that the chronicler of other people's stories is, in a way, equally important, but that the chronicler also has a narrative that is worth telling. So that's why the story is told by Alex, even though the mother really is the focus. And when I was writing the book, I was sort of feeling in the dark. I didn't have a plan. I just really wanted to have fun. And because I wasn't planning and following instinct, really, I found that I dug up a whole bunch of my own thoughts on parents and children and the whole parent-child relationship, which is different from the mother-daughter or mother-son relationship and has its own sort of awkward associations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's also a coming-of-age story for Alex. Mm-hmm. Because Alex leaves home at around 13, this starts.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting in the book, it's very topical, because Alex's gender, mm-hmm. Alex is named but not gendered,
mm-hmm.
whereas Ma is gendered but not named. Mm-hmm. And what happens through life, and this is very topical, like, well, what pronouns are we supposed to, like, what are your pronouns, and mm-hmm. how are we supposed to call you? Mm-hmm. And to me, it was a very elegant example of how you don't have to, and eventually by the end of the book, it doesn't become, you know, our curiosity is like, oh, right, we know Alex, mm-hmm. which is important. And in the same way as we feel that we know Ma, even though mm-hmm. we never know her name. Mm-hmm.
Darling, I only listen to Radio Gorgeous. Aha!
Tell me your thought process around creating the character of Alex and keeping Ma nameless.
Well, to start off with the character of Alex, I began with Alex's voice, and I think I was maybe the first chapter in when I realized that Alex didn't have a gender, and because the way I seem to create characters is to start with their voice, and then as I continue in that voice, I realize who they are rather than designing a character from scratch. And so it wasn't really my intention to write about a genderless character. It was more I wanted to write a novel, and the narrators turned out to be genderless. But that worked, I think, in the best interest of the novel, because it is a lot about how people's identities are tied to how others see them, because the mother is the mother because we are seeing her through Alex's eyes. If Alex didn't exist, she wouldn't be a mother. Alex is a child because Ma exists. So all of the people really in the novel are defined by their relationships to each other, and the reason that Alex seems to get in trouble so much is that they refuse to define themselves in terms of what other people want, and that causes friction. And in different ways, that caused friction for the mother. And was your other question about the mother, and I forgot.
Being nameless.
Being nameless, that was an accident. I only realized, I think, about... And actually, it was more difficult for me, in just technically in the writing of it, to keep the mother nameless than it was to keep Alex genderless. That was really easy compared to keeping the mother nameless and then deciding whether or not the mother should be nameless. And now talking about the mother without a name is actually a pain.
Yeah, but she's Ma.
Yeah, she's Ma, but that's the thing, because parents, especially when we're very young, parents don't have names. Parents don't have identities outside of ourselves.
It's the role.
Yeah, I remember when I was little, my mother for the longest time was Sarah's mother. She just lost her name. And even though Alex grows up throughout the book, realizes that Ma has a past and identity, Alex never quite gets past thinking of Ma as Ma. Mm-hmm. And the father never has a name either, but I think that's less of an issue because mm-hmm. he's less present.
Yes, he's less known to us. Mm. And the title of the book is Laura's, mm-hmm. The Laura's. And the Laura's, it is populated by Laura's. They are the pinpoints on the map. They are like pearls on a string throughout Ma's life. Tell us a little bit about that part of the book.
Well, that was an element that I actually, during the editing process, I had to fight to keep. And there were, in the first draft, several more Laura's that have been axed.
You've been put under the bus.
Yes. Yes, but there are... They didn't cease to exist in her past. They just ceased to exist on the page. And the Laura's are people that Ma has met throughout her life, usually women. I don't think there are any male Laura's that are mentioned, but usually women who have had an immoderate effect on who she is as a person and who have left sort of a mark on her in a positive way. And I chose the name Laura because I have known a lot of Laura's and they have generally affected me. And so I wanted to stick with that name just in memory of them. That, and it was an incredibly common name for a while. And I think I know 15 or 16 Laura's.
I was going to say, there were a bunch, you know, mm-hmm. littered, you know, throughout elementary school. Mm-hmm. You know, the place was lousy with Laura's.
Oh, yeah, and it does seem to happen, because when I was really little, I lived next door to a girl named Laura, and she was my best friend for the longest time. And so every time I met a girl named Laura, it just sort of sparked something, a bit of familiarity. But I think people do that, is you recognize someone you have known in other people, either in the name or the voice or the habits, or being in the country that I wasn't born in, often I'll hear American voices and be drawn to them for nothing other than the fact that they sound like me. And so like attracts like in weird ways, and we let those people influence us possibly more than we would otherwise.
Yes, and it's interesting. Everything is what we imbue it with. And even as you were saying, you know, okay, so the name is sort of, it's something that resonates in us, and we attribute characteristics to them that they don't necessarily have, or give them a weight and an importance that they don't necessarily have. And we do that with family, is what you were saying. And on the one hand, I mean, I was adopted, and so I do spend a lot of time thinking about family, and then you take family in a broader sense, and you think about nationhood, and you think about war, and this, you think, it's all, we're all just people, and this family is how we arrive here, you know what I mean? I just, this importance, but it's your family, you know, and yet that is important, and is that important just because it's biologically, physically, conditionally, experientially important? Is it important because we say it's important? Is it, you know, it's these, I appreciate your exploring these things that we get, we take as givens, you know, in our lives.
Radio Gorgeous, gorgeous lives.
I think a lot of it is we need it to be important. We need to just create lines of demarcation for people groups and for families, because we need order, because it's insanely arbitrary how each individual arrives on the planet. It's completely up to chance what country you're born in, what group you're born to, who you're surrounded with, and we seem to hang everything on it. And I've been thinking a lot just about the concept of nationality recently, because we let it be the excuse to do so many things, not all of them good. And we put so much weight on it, and really why. It seems to be actually a really modern invention that we're letting drag us around by the tail, essentially. But then I think just the whole idea of nationality bothers me, because I feel like I don't really have one. My mother was an immigrant, and I've emigrated now, so I'm doubly divorced from any real cultural feeling. And a lot of the people I'm friends with have also had that same experience. One of my closest friends, her father is from Scotland, her mother is American, she lives in England, she has two passports, and she doesn't really feel like she belongs anywhere. And that seems to be the case for so many people I know, that we don't fit in these little boxes that everyone seems to want to cut the world into. And it makes, not fitting makes the boxes just seem really silly.
So essentially, we identify with family and nation just because we like patterns.
Yes!
This is basically pattern making. Mm-hmm. Orderly pattern making. But yeah, I have that same experience with countryhood, because, you know, I have the family that I grew up in with one identity, and their nationalities as taken on by us adopted children culturally. And then there was my biological mother was born in Switzerland. My biological father had Scottish, of Scottish descent and pretension. He called himself, he was the Thane of Rhodey. He called himself John Thane Ballancourt, something or other. Anywho, but yeah, so, and I'm married to an Englishman, and I live in England. It's very confusing, and the assumptions we make about each other, you know, sort of Americans sort of currently eyeing each other warily. Where are you on the Trump question and the Brexit question? You know what I mean? Like, you know, I was in North Carolina recently. I'm like, I'm just going to shut up. I'm saying nothing. One thing I wanted to talk to you is to talk more broadly than the book and talk about you a bit, because I understand you were homeschooled, which is another topical thing. Tell me about your homeschooling experience, because there's...
Oh, is it topical?
Oh, well, maybe just to me.
Okay.
That's something I've thought about.
No,
I thought a lot about.
When I was born in Fairfax County, and when I was just about old enough for preschool, my dad went to register me, and he found out how big the classes were going to be and how big the school district was. And I refused to speak to anyone that wasn't my parents. And so he looked at me, and he looked at the registration forms, and he said, we can't do this to her. It's just, this isn't going to work. Let's keep her at home. So they kept me at home for another year, and they kept me at home for another year, and they kept me at home for another year, and they just continued to do that until I got to college age. And then my first day of school was going off to the community college at the age of 17, and my mother made me take the picture and everything. But their major concerns for it were sort of personal and educational. And then when I got older, everyone that we knew had said, well, homeschool up until high school, but obviously they're going to either Christian or public high school. And my mother said, well, why would you do that? That's when they're the most impressionable and they're most at risk. I mean, that's a bad idea. So I stayed home the entire way through, and I think, I don't know if it's the right thing for everyone or even the right thing for most people, but it was good for me because I discovered quite early on that if I got my work done in a timely manner, I could do whatever I wanted. So I started waking up at 5 in the morning, doing all of my schoolwork in bed, and by the time everyone else was waking up and having breakfast, I was done. And so I was allowed to read immoderately, and
I had a feeling that there was a lot of reading.
There was a lot. I think there was a phase of my life right after we moved and I had no friends and there was no one in my age group around that was open to having more friends because they all went to public school. And
they had their friends.
They had their friends. That I think I was reading 2 or 3 full-length young adult novels a day just because there was nothing else to do. And my brother wasn't as driven, so he was doing schoolwork all day long. So
layabout.
Well, he's made something of himself. He just got a job working as a physicist. So
he's all right.
He's all right. He's all right.
He's all right. He'll pass.
My weekday fix, darling. It has to be Radio Gorgeous.
So what was that feeling like, though, when you went to community school?
It was. It was interesting because community college, I don't know if the listeners would know, but it's sort of, it bridges the gap between high school and a traditional university where you can take some classes and build up credits. And it was crazy. I'd never heard that much cursing before in my life, but the work was really boring and easy. So I had no problem with the work. It was more sort of a little fishbowl in which I could get used to normal human beings mm-hmm. before going out in the wide, wide world.
And it was a casual intro.
It was a casual intro, and it was, I enjoyed it because it confirmed to me that I could do the work, because I'd had really no outside barometer except for the yearly standardized tests, which had always been easy, and I assumed had been easy for everyone. So it was strange.
There was no comparison.
There was no comparison. Mm. There really wasn't anybody else's experience, because everybody I knew that homeschooled differently.
I would say, because homeschooling, you know, when... You know, and I considered it for my son. My mother laughed at me, and she's right. In fact, my patience level is, you know, mm-hmm. It's not for me. It would have been great for my son mm-hmm. If he had a different mother, mm-hmm. Or if his father had stayed home, because mm-hmm. you know that patience level would have worked out well. Actually, I'm thinking about it, I'm like, why didn't we do that? But so much of it is that the materials that are now available mm-hmm. is religious homeschooling, which mm-hmm. is one of the things that came up in the book. And that is a very, very different mm-hmm. Track mm-hmm. And different ideas of what you're being protected from mm-hmm. And exposed to. Mm-hmm. So were a lot of the people who were... Or homeschool. So you didn't have your parents didn't have anybody to do this with, because I know people mm-hmm. there's a big community mm-hmm. here that's not religious mm-hmm. in homeschooling, although there's some of that as well. But there's just a mm-hmm. homeschooling, you know, community. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like your parents were quite isolated.
There was a homeschooling community, and when I was younger, when we still lived in Fairfax, we were part of it, and then we moved to the middle of nowhere when I was about 8 or 9, and it took a while for that community to build back up. And there were some people there. I think there were just enough people that we used to put everyone together in a 15-passenger van and go to the District of Columbia to go to the Kennedy Center all together, because we qualified as a school group. And we did do things together, but it was mostly field trips of that nature. And then my brother and sister were younger than 5 years and 10 years, 9 years or so younger than me. So they were of an age to benefit from the sudden influx of people to our county. And they actually took part in a cooperative school for a while. So they got the big group experience. And I kind of missed that because I was born at the wrong point, I suppose.
Yeah. Those bastards.
Yeah. No, they seem to really like it, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, and they had a different sense of community. I was wondering also if your PhD work and whatever, mm-hmm. now schooling, you know, and imagine, because writing is a lonely mm-hmm. profession, mm-hmm. that provides community mm-hmm. and like-minded people.
It does. I've found I'm just by nature, I tend to gravitate more towards one or two close friends rather than having a wide circle of friends. And the PhD sort of has provided one or two people who are like-minded and sort of obsessed with the same things. And we socialize together and we trade work together. But mostly it is very lonely, just sort of plugging away at the books for hours on end. But I'm kind of used to that at this point. I feel like it's the thing I've been training for my entire life, and now I finally get to do it.
Do you still have the same schedule of get up early, get the work done, and read all day?
I don't get up as early anymore, mostly because my husband likes to stay up late, but I still do take the top half of the morning and devote it to work, and then the afternoon usually devolves into reading. And I might read incredibly promiscuously. It's just everything.
A big slutty reader.
Yes.
We like it. We call that Catholic with a small C. Or slutty.
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Sarah Taylor.
Thank you.
RadioGorgeous.com.